On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training on solidification stabilization. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Solidification Stabilization Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's call. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC Solidification Stabilization Team. As listed on the slide, today's training is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance Document, Development of Performance Specifications for Solidification Stabilization. We call it the SS-1 document. Today's training is an introduction to this document, and we do recommend that you review the document itself. And at the end of the training class, we're going to take you to a link where you can download the document. We also make available the presentation that you'll see during today's training. In addition to what's on the slides, we do have more information available in the notes section of the downloaded version. And again, at the end of the training, we're going to take you to a link where you can download both the document as well as the presentation. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN. Moving to slide two, if you're new to this form of the CLUIN website, it's a series of orange buttons along the top that allow you to navigate, and most often you use the third button, the single right arrow, to move forward through the presentation. The slide numbers are listed in the upper left corner, and our trainers are going to say the slide number throughout today's presentation, and you're in charge of the slides at your location, and you'll keep up using those orange buttons along the top. Today's course is scheduled for 2.25 hours. We're going to have question and answer breaks, one in the middle and another at the end. For the phone line audience, you have the option of asking questions out loud, and we'll remind you at the question and answer breaks how to unmute your phone so that you can ask questions. For the simulcast audience, it's the orange question mark at the top of the slide that allows you to send in questions. And anyone is welcome to use that orange question mark button to send in questions or comments at any time during today's training. On our last slide, we have a link to our feedback form. We do ask that everyone on the call today take just a few minutes to fill out the feedback form at the end of today's training. Today's event is being recorded, and we offer archives of past ITRC training courses. On slide three, the notes section of this slide includes the ITRC disclaimer. In short, our disclaimer says that we've tried to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with state, local, and federal laws and experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. You can also access the ITRC disclaimer and copyright information on the ITRC website. On slide four, at the top of the slide, we do list the URL for the ITRC website. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. Overall, we're a network that's led by state regulators. Our federal partners include Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. We also include members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. This diverse group works together to address a wide variety of topics that may be targeted for a specific technology or type of site or type of contaminant. We communicate our results through our products, our technical and regulatory guidance documents, and our internet-based and classroom training. On slide five, you can see a list of course topics that ITRC has recently addressed. These are topics that are available for training in 2013. We continue to offer popular courses from previous years, as well as develop new courses each year. We're also offering a two-day classroom training on elm apples. The next class is October 1 and 2 in Garden Grove, California. You can visit the ITRC website to learn more about all of these classes, as well as sign up for upcoming classes. On slide 6, I'll introduce our trainers. All of our trainers were members of the ITRC Solidification Stabilization Team. Wilmer Reyes is an environmental engineer with the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. He is a project manager performing investigations and cleanup activities at state and federal Superfund sites, including brownfields. Wilmer is the team leader for the ITRC Solidification Stabilization Team. Tom Plant is a senior remediation engineer with Haley and Aldrich, located in Portland, Maine. His solidification experience includes solidification of fly ash ponds, non-aqueous phase liquid containment, mixed waste sites involving organic and inorganics, complex solidification projects involving source and groundwater remedies, hydraulic and geochemical models, and the use of additives for organic compound attenuation. Raj Singh is a senior remediation engineer at Kleinfelder in Exton, Pennsylvania. He is responsible for technical oversight of remediation projects throughout the firm. As part of solidification stabilization closure projects, he directed waste characterization, treatability testing, process scale-up, engineering plans and specifications, contractor bid evaluation, and managed the construction oversight and obtained no further action approval. Jim Harrington is the director in the Division of Environmental Remediation at the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. He is responsible for three sections that manage the remediation of contaminated sites on Long Island and in the Eastern Adirondack region. Jim has been a member of ITRC since its inception in 1995 and is the ITRC state point of contact for New York. On slide 7, I'll turn today's presentation over to Wilmer Reyes of the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. Wilmer?
Yeah. Thank you, Ileana. In this slide, basically, we have an outline of the general format of the guidance on today's presentation. I will be presenting the technical introduction as well as the general overview of the technology. In this presentation, the team assumes that the technology has already been selected and that you are looking for some guidance with establishing and evaluating technology performance. This is especially important when you are involved with the design, implementation, and long-term stewardship programs related to the SS technology. Moving to slide number 8, we want to start with some definitions of solidification stabilization according to EPA. As you can see, SS is defined as a two different processes. We have solidification that involves mechanical mixing of the contaminated material with reagents. The most common in the market is Portland cement to transform the waste into a solid material that entraps the contaminants and reduce the rate of leaching. With stabilization, on the other hand, the process involves chemical reactions between the reagents and the contaminated material to form a stable, less soluble material. Here we have an example. This is applicable more for oil-based paints. In the equation we have when lead hydrogen carbonate reacts with calcium sulfate, in the presence of water, a more stable lead sulfate is formed, which reduces the solubility of lead into groundwater. And that is what you are looking where implementation of the technology. Moving to slide number 9, we have here a representation of the process. We define in the slide before SS as a two separate processes, but in practice they often occur simultaneously to a single treatment process. On the before application, contamination is represented in brown, with contaminants leaving the site. When the technology is applied, what you see on the right side of the slide, cement-based solidified material is formed, and this entraps the contaminant in the mix. This 3D material has a direct effect on the physical properties of the monolith. And this also, in the after application, groundwater is represented surrounding the monolith because SS decreases the surface area exposed to leaching. In slide number 10, here is a good example of oily soil that has been treated with solidification stabilization. The transformation process increases the strength, reduces hydraulic inductivity and leachability, which are the key components to measure remedy success. These components are going to be discussed further in the presentation. Moving into slide number 11. Here we have a couple of pictures of the application. On the left, the technology is applied to an auger equipment to treat coal tar contaminants at a former gas plant. On the right, the SS is applied with the use of tobacco to treat contaminant sediments resulting from a steel mill operation. You can find in the actual document additional information on equipment, and this is more detailed in the Appendix A of the guidance. Moving into slide number 12. This is a good chart of representation for taken from the EPA annual status report. As you can see, solidification stabilization have been selected as a source control remedy at more than 200 sites. Although this information seems to be a little probably larger now, this is from 2009 annual report, but even that already represented 20% of the remedy selected at CERCLA. Superfund projects. This is reflected in ex situ as well as in situ applications. Slide number 13. When considering the use of technology, a good understanding of the outcomes and limitations is important. One of the major advantages of the technology is that it can be applicable to a wide range of contaminants. This includes organic and inorganic contaminants. The technology can be applied to in situ or ex situ treatment in a relative short period of time. This is, for example, when you compare it to chemical oxidation. The soil properties can also be improved, which can be a relevant component for redevelopment. And also, reagent application can be done in dry or sometimes in wet conditions, which is important sometimes to eliminate the watering. And also, SS has shown to be more cost-effective than off-site removal and off-site disposal. Now, something to keep in mind is that site-specific conditions will determine the potential effectiveness of the technology, and therefore will determine the applicability of the advantage provided in the table. In slide number 14, here we have the challenges seen more in the during technology application. This, one of the major ones is that the contaminants will remain at the site. Sometimes this triggers land restrictions and uncertainties associated with prediction of performance over time. Also, sometimes chemical or physical setting can create some type of water, groundwater mounding, or increase in volume that requires additional design and management. Now, sometimes, you know, when implemented, after implementation, the technology is also limited to options for retreatment. And many times, the excavation of underground structures, for example, utility lines, concrete slabs, are necessary prior to treatment. Removing these obstructions sometimes it's not feasible, which may represent additional challenge for implementation of the technology. In slide number 15, here we have a little more detail of the potential application of the technology to organic contaminants. This table is based on EPA and oil references. Based on experience, the technology has been demonstrated to be applicable to PAHs, PCBs, pesticides, and is also considered to be potentially effective for dioxin furans and some VOC components. In this, sometimes with the use of some pretreatment. Again, the performance of the effectiveness has to be demonstrated on a 5x5 basis. In slide number 16, there is definitely more experience and solidification stabilization has been demonstrated for many of the inorganic contaminants. It has shown to be effective for heavy metals, asbestos, and most inorganics. Slide number 17. Now, this basically shows what is addressed in the solidification and stabilization guidance. In the pre-chart, we have a representation of the different entities that pretty much represent the S-esteem. From the common experience of the team, we identified three main technology barriers. One is inconsistency to develop performance specifications. These refer to strength, hydraulic conductivity, and leachability. Limitation for address uncertainties related to long-term performance. And the last one is to provide criteria for measuring post-remedy compliance through long-term stewardship programs. Again, all these components will be addressed in more detail through the presentation. Slide number 18. Here we have, Andy was going to be presenting the introduction of the concepts and selection of performance specifications. Raj is going to discuss traceability studies. Tom will be addressed solidification and stabilization implementation, and Jim will be presenting the long-term stewardship issues, including presenting a case study to illustrate the application of the technology. In slide number 19, consultants and regulators can benefit from the training by identifying and selecting performance specifications to measure technology success. For site owners and stakeholders, the guidance will facilitate the understanding of the advantages and challenges of the technology, and also acceptance of the technology when selected as a remedy. Now, if we move to slide number 20, here is following the presentation outline. Now I'm turning the presentation over to Andy, who will be introducing performance specifications. Andy?
This is Juliana, and today Andy's not available, but special thanks to Tom Plant from Haley and Aldrich for filling in for him, and I'll turn it over to Tom.
Thanks, Juliana and Wilmer. So again, this is Tom Plant with Haley and Aldrich. So the next section of our presentation here is the area that I'll cover, sections 3 and 4. And these are related to how solidified materials behave in the environment and the development of performance specifications for the design and implementation of solidification and stabilization remedies. So moving to slide 21, first thing I want to introduce is a couple of definitions that are used throughout the guidance document and will be used further in this presentation. And they are basically the concepts of performance goals, and performance specifications. Now, starting with performance goals, material performance goals are basically what you want the remedy to achieve with solidification. They're typically going to be pre-established material targets based on your site remediation goals, and they essentially describe how the solidification or stabilization remedy fits into the overall remediation approach. So, for example, you know, a material performance goal may be something like reduced permeability, a leaching rate or a contaminant flux reduction, whether as a percentage or as a set value, isolation of the contaminants, source containment, any number of things on how does this solidification component fit into your overall remedy. Now, the performance specifications themselves, these are sets of parameters, tests, and criteria that establish the acceptable performance for the treated material and will result in a material that meets your overall material performance goals. The specifications or the performance specifications may be developed to describe the treated material performance to serve as targets for the development of mixed designs during bench scale testing, or they can also be used to establish a baseline or baseline conditions or expectations for consistency and compliance testing between your field implemented materials during construction and your lab formulated mixed designs. So the performance specifications can be referred to as material performance specifications during the bench scale testing when you're looking at establishing what is acceptable material performance. And then we call them construction performance specifications during the implementation. And there can be a little bit of a difference there. So whereas the material performance specifications will test the ability of the treated material to meet the site remedial goals, the construction performance specification may differ slightly in that they'll be used to ensure that the field-treated materials during construction are consistent with the lab-treated materials. And so, again, they may involve a slightly modified set of tests or criteria. Moving on to slide 22. As Wilmer mentioned, one of the perceived disadvantages of solidification may be that the contaminants remain in place after remediation, so they're not removed, they're not destroyed. Now, while it's true that they remain in place, these contaminants are retained by both chemical and physical means, generally within a low hydraulic conductivity material, which then exhibits much improved leaching characteristics as compared to the untreated material. Now, both organic and inorganic contaminants can be retained within a solidified material. However, the mechanisms of retention tend to be slightly different. For the inorganic contaminants, let's say metals, for example, more often than not, these are stabilized by alkalinity. So you're basically changing the pH of the treated material such that the metals exist in a less soluble form or less soluble species. They can often be absorbed to the mineral surfaces or incorporated into the mineral structure of the soil or the solidified matrix. Organic contaminants, on the other hand, that are often targeted with solidification or stabilization tend to be more often associated with a solid or semi-solid organic phase, such as a tar or a grease. And these contaminants within that matrix slowly partition into the pore water from these phases or these tarry phases, while to a lesser degree they may be absorbing to mineral surfaces. During solidification treatment, additives can be included in the mix design to specifically absorb certain organic contaminants. As the formulation cures, the additives that have absorbed the contaminants are then encapsulated within the solidified matrix, so they effectively have absorbed and now contain and bind these organic contaminants. On slide 23, this slide depicts a typical scenario of solidified material in the environment. So in the subsurface, a solidified or stabilized material is subject to several inputs and outputs or conditions. The treated material needs to be strong enough to resist an overlying distributed load, which may be the overlying soil, a cover, post-treatment site development, construction equipment, any number of things. And for applications below the water table, there's typically going to be a horizontal flow of groundwater which contacts the treated material. The contaminants that are retained within the treated material can then leach into groundwater, where these contaminants will travel to some downgradient point of compliance, such as a compliance well or a surface water body. Along the way, these leached contaminants will tend to decrease in concentration due to your typical, attenuation, dispersion, dilution mechanisms, such that oftentimes when using a point of compliance scenario, an allowable leaching rate or concentration at the treated material, maybe one or two orders of magnitude greater than what's allowable at the point of compliance, just basically due to these attenuation mechanisms. So, one important aspect to understand, too, as we go through this training, solidification and stabilization do not necessarily result in 100% elimination of leaching of the contaminants. The goal is really to, change the condition from an untreated situation where the leaching is likely unacceptable and causing groundwater impacts to a situation where the leaching is drastically reduced to a point where the leaching rate is manageable and the environment that it's in can handle the lower rate of leaching. Now on slide 24, we identify three key performance parameters for solidified materials. And these were the primary ones that the team identified through their experience and are described in the guidance document. Based on the interactions with the environment that I just presented on the previous slide, these key parameters are strength, which is really the ability to withstand the overlying loads, hydraulic conductivity, which is the ability of the treated material to limit exposure of the contaminants to either infiltrating or groundwater flowing through it, and leachability, which is the ability to retain the contamination within the treated material. These three parameters are typically used to define the performance characteristics of a solidified or stabilized material. However, it's important to recognize that not all these parameters may be pertinent for every site, and sometimes additional parameters may be identified. Case in point would be for metals. If metals are being treated with stabilization solely to, change the species and the solubility of the metals by a pH alkalinity change, you may not be using a cementitious material that creates a low permeability monolith. So there's differences in the type of treatment, and the performance parameters will vary based on the type of treatment and the material performance goals. In slide 25, so strength is probably one of the most commonly used parameters for solidification, and it's an indicator of chemical reaction or binding for cementitious reagents. So in as an example, a lack of strength gain in a treated material would indicate either that there's not enough reagent quantity has been added to solidify the material, or there could be a physical or chemical condition or contaminant within the material being treated that is inhibiting the hydration of the cement. Now, a secondary purpose for using or for testing for strength is that it also can be used as an indirect indicator of durability. As a general rule, materials with higher initial compressive strength are typically considered to be more resistant to aging or weathering reactions. So the strength can be used as an indicator that these reactions are occurring and the material will be durable. The durability and the strength gain can be used to evaluate how various additives affect the mix. In some cases, a maximum strength value may also be considered, depending on what the future use of the site is. For example, if some excavation through solidified material is contemplated some point down the road for utilities or construction, then a maximum strength value that still allows for excavation with normal excavation equipment is sometimes used. Slide 26, hydraulic conductivity. This measures the ease or difficulty of water movement through a porous material. And while the property itself is important, especially when solidifying material, the relative hydraulic conductivity, or the difference between treated and untreated materials adjacent to each other is an important concept with solidification. This relative hydraulic conductivity will determine the water contact mode for the treated material, and therefore will affect the primary leaching mechanism. And if we go to slide 27, a couple of illustrations here to illustrate this point. On the left-hand side, we have a situation where the hydraulic conductivity of the treated material, or the SS material, is much lower than the surrounding soil in which it sits. So in this scenario, groundwater flow is essentially diverted around the material, and the exposed surface area for contaminants to leach is really limited to the external surfaces of this monolithic block. So in this situation, the contaminant release rate is controlled by the rate of mass transfer from within the solidified monolith to the surface, where it can then solubilize into groundwater. This is generally referred to as diffusion-controlled release. On the right-hand side, we have a scenario where the hydraulic conductivity of the treated material is about the same as that of the surrounding soil. So in this case, you essentially still have sort of a granular porous material where the groundwater can percolate through the material. And so the continuous pore areas within that material are exposed to the groundwater, and so the leaching can occur within those pores as the groundwater passes through the material. So the release concentrations in this scenario will be based on the liquid-solid partitioning, or local equilibrium within the pore spaces. So this would be referred to as an equilibrium-controlled release. Now, the important concept here is contaminant release under these equilibrium conditions, or think of it as the flow-through porous media, is always going to be greater than under the mass transfer or diffusion-limited conditions. So this is an important concept as to why, you know, lowering the permeability of a treated material relative to the surrounding material changes to a much lower rate of contaminant release scenario. Slide 28. So leachability is the potential for something to release contaminants. It can be described either as the extent of leaching or how much mass can be released from this treated material, or it can also be expressed as a rate of leaching or a mass transport or mass flux per unit of time as well. And again, even solidified materials are going to leach, and the goal is to reduce the leaching to an acceptable level. Now, the leaching itself is the process of solid material constituents or contaminants moving into a contacting liquid phase. And this is the principal pathway for the organic and inorganic non-volatile contaminants to release in solidified materials. Now, the leachability property of a treated or an untreated material is typically determined based on the results of one or more leaching tests, and there are a whole number of different types of leaching tests, and a few of them are listed here. You know, there's promulgated leaching tests, which a lot of you have probably heard of, such as the TCLP, or toxicity characteristic leaching procedure, and the SPLP test. There's some consensus standards, which really just means they're out there, they're used fairly often, they apply to particular treatment scenarios. And ASTM and American Nuclear Society have a number of tests which may be appropriate for certain scenarios. And there's also some emerging EPA leaching methods, which I'll talk about a little bit. Now, one caution in using leaching tests is that to select an appropriate leaching method, as some of the most commonly used leaching tests are designed for specific purposes or specific scenarios, which may or may not represent the leachability measurement for your treated materials. For example, the TCLP and SPLP tests, you know, as promulgated, were designed for testing materials that are either going to be exposed to low pH landfill leachate, organic acids, or exposure to an acid rain scenario. And these specimens are typically crushed up and tumbled over about 18 hours with the leachant material. So they're a very aggressive test designed to see, you know, what may be released from the material. But these tests do not directly mimic a solidified material in the ground where a monolithic form is created, because the test would destroy the reduced permeability property of the material. So, you know, it's important to read through in the ITRC document as well as some of the references that, you know, choosing a leaching test, you don't necessarily just pick something off the shelf. You've got to give some thought as to what behaviors you're trying to either model or understand. On slide 29, so a couple of the new emerging methods, these were developed by Vanderbilt University and are undergoing the final stages of approval through EPA for inclusion in SW 846. And as of the time of this training today, they may be pretty close or actually promulgated. These are called the Leaching Environmental Assessment Framework, or LEAF for short, and it consists of four leaching test methods, and there are also some data management tools and some assessment approaches that are included in this method. There are some references to this method in the ITRC guidance document, as well as Vanderbilt University has a webpage where you can download some of the information on these tests. These tests are designed to provide a material-specific source term for release of contaminants. And these source terms can be used to demonstrate treatment effectiveness by comparing untreated and treated materials, by determining release estimates, or can also be used as source terms in fate and transport modeling. So these leaching tests don't really look at a specific placement scenario. They really are looking at a broad range of material characteristics and leaching behaviors over a wide range of conditions. Now, looking at slide 30, so in this slide, this figure is a simplified version of a figure within the ITRC document. It shows a solidified material and the various leaching and physical factors that influence the material performance. Now, in terms of the leaching performance, the figure identifies the three primary factors, the pH, the liquid to solid ratio, and the rates of mass transport as being significant to leaching performance of well-treated and untreated materials. And these are the three primary focuses of these leaf leaching methods. Not really going to get into much more detail on these methods, but just wanted to make everyone aware that there are some sort of more appropriate and newer methods that are starting to be used. Slide 31, this just identifies the methods. There's they're called pre-methods here, and until they're finally promulgated, they're designated as that. But, you know, there'll be EPA methods 1313 through 1316, and these bullets here just describe basically what material properties these leaching methods evaluate. So in general, moving on to slide 32, where are leaching tests useful? So during the mixed design or treatability testing phase, they're helpful in selecting reagents and comparing the leaching performance of various mixed designs, you know, against each other. And they can then also be used as a baseline for comparison to field-treated materials. You know, for compliance, you know, if a leaching value or a concentration in groundwater is determined to be a compliance scenario that you need to meet for your site, then you can use the leaching test to derive a groundwater concentration that may result after the treatability the solidification is performed. Again, you can use leaching tests in the field to provide some level of assurance that the materials you're treating in the field are consistent with those you treated in the lab and that you're getting comparable performance results. And finally, leaching test data, either mass flux rates or concentrations in leachate, can also be used as source terms for fate and transport modeling. On slide 33, so a couple slides here on, you know, how leaching data can be represented and how it can be used. In this slide here, we're looking at phenanthrene release from an MGP or a coal tar site over time. There were a couple of different methods used here. The brown diamonds represent leaching concentrations over time for untreated material, and the red squares represent the leaching rates or the concentrations over time for treated material. And basically, just as a real simple comparison, you can see that the treated material, the leaching of the treated material is significantly lower than the untreated material. So these different leaching test methods can help you develop charts like this to demonstrate how successful or the treatment will be. On slide 34, another way to use the leaching test, as I mentioned, is to compare different mix designs. So on the chart on the left, we're looking at the phenanthrene mass flux rate of a treated material over time. And we have a couple of specimens. One is treated with what's called a baseline mix, the red squares, which is probably just a cementitious reagent to solidify the material. The green diamonds would be that baseline mix with some bentonite added, and the blue circles are that same baseline mix with some organoclay added. So in this left-hand chart, you can see that the addition of organoclay was beneficial in lowering the mass flux rate of phenanthrene in this particular sample, so increased retention of the contaminants. Conversely, looking at a highly volatile compound such as xylene, same types of mixes, we don't see any real difference in the leaching rate between, you know, cement alone or adding the bentonite or the organoclay. So again, the leaching test can be used during the treatability study to evaluate the relative performance of the mix designs. And slide 35, I won't really go through these. Some of these are captured in the document. Just some typical performance test methods used for strength, conductivity, and leachability. Slide 36. So we've talked a little bit about material behavior in the environment and the leaching tests. What I want to introduce here is the concept that is throughout the document and the rest of this training, which is this solidification stabilization process flowchart. This is the framework around which the guidance document is structured, and this flowchart illustrates the design and implementation process for solidification and serves as a roadmap through the major steps, decision points, and operations conducted for a typical solidification remedy. So if we move to slide 37, the solidification process flowchart is comprised of three color-coded columns of information. The center column with the blue background represents the actions taken through the process, from defining material performance goals to conducting treatability studies to implementation and long-term monitoring. The actions in this middle column are supported by inputs, the green column on the left, and what we call considerations, the orange column on the right. Now, if we go to slide 38, so the inputs to the solidification design and implementation process include all the known information about the site, as well as any conceptual models and goals for the treatment process and site remediation as a whole. For example, is the solidification stabilization treatment being used as the sole site remedy, or will there be a separate groundwater treatment component? Are the primary contaminants metals and inorganics, or are they organics? Is the contamination deep or shallow, and what type of equipment or solidification process is likely to be used? So these types of site information and overall remedial goals will help to shape the solidification stabilization design and the implementation process. Moving to slide 39, so the considerations over on the right-hand column for the solidification process include what we refer to as bounding information, or information that helps to shape the decisions made in the actions column. This information can include pre-established goals or guidelines, key performance parameters applied to the site, common practice and techniques acquired through experience with remediation and solidification. So, for example, there may be regulations regarding where compliance is measured, such as at a property boundary or an area of concern limit, in which case you may be looking at sort of a point of compliance scenario to measure success, or the level of leaching reduction or an acceptable leachate concentration may have been determined through a fate and transport model. So these would be specific criteria or conditions that you want your solidification to meet. So all these types of considerations help to determine the types of performance tests and to develop the criteria and specifications for the remedy. So on slide 40, as an example of how the inputs and considerations columns, you know, act together and affect the actions, let's look at the first action in the flowchart, which is define the material performance goals. As I described previously, the material performance goals are design targets that describe a treated material that will meet specific site remediation goals. These design targets will form the basis for developing the performance specifications for the design and implementation and are used to formulate a list of characteristics to be assessed during the treatability testing. The material performance goals that are used to determine how a solidified material should perform, these should be based on the information that is typically contained in a conceptual site model, such as groundwater flow, hydraulic conductivity, type and extent of contamination, and also the role that solidification will play in the overall remedial goals for the site and a general idea of how the solidification treatment will be implemented. So the specifics of the material performance goals will be shaped by the considerations of where and how the goals will be assessed. For example, as a percent reduction in leaching at the source, or as an absolute groundwater concentration at some downgradient well surface water body, or it could be as simple as a defined low permeability value for the treated material. If you remember the relative permeability concept, you know, in many cases, if you're getting 3 or 4 orders of magnitude lower permeability by a treated material, while a lot of these other mechanisms that reducing leachability are important, that may be your primary mechanism affecting the outcome of your treatment. So slide 41, so this is just an example of some of the materials performance goals I just talked about. And again, looking at sort of the generic situation of a solidified monolith in groundwater and measuring at some point of compliance for the overall success of the remedy. So some example material performance goals could be, you know, the material needs to support overlying subsurface or operational loads or future use loads such as, you know, site development. A performance goal may be providing for diversion of groundwater around the material to reduce the water contact with the material and to perhaps address the remedial goals for groundwater at a point of compliance. Now, on slide 42, the material performance specifications. So, the next, once the material performance goals are established, the next step in the design and implementation process is the development of the material performance specifications. Now, whereas the material performance goals provide the basis for how the solidification remedy as a whole should behave, material performance specifications are the set of performance parameters, tests, and criteria that describe the minimum measurable performance of an acceptable treated material formulation. And these specifications are a critical component in the development of the treatment for, with solidification. The material performance specifications are developed to guide the evaluation of whether the treated material will meet the performance goals and the site remediation goals. The ITRC document, as I mentioned, identified unconfined compressive strength, hydraulic conductivity, and leachability as the most commonly applied performance criteria for solidified stabilized materials. So wrapping up this section of the training, just a couple things to remember. We define material performance specifications and construction performance specifications to describe what we expect or how we expect the material or the treated material to behave and what types of tests and criteria are we going to use to ensure that the treatment accomplishes those behaviors. The key performance parameters are strength, hydraulic conductivity, especially relative hydraulic conductivity, and leachability. There's some new emerging leaching methods being promulgated by EPA, the LEAF methods, and there are a number of example performance tests that are described in the guidance document. And again, this flow chart is provided in the guidance document as Figure 4-1. So with that, we are now coming to the first break in the training, and I'll turn it back over to Juliana.
Thank you, Tom. On slide 44, we are going to take a short break for questions. For our phone line audience, you're welcome to unmute your phone. It's #6 to unmute in our system. So you need to unmute at your location and select #6 to unmute your line. For simulcast participants, and if you'd like to, if you're on the phone line, you're welcome to send in questions using the orange question mark button at the top of the slides. When you do ask a question out loud, please state your name, the organization you're with, and the location that you're calling in from. You're also welcome to refer to a specific slide number. Along the left in the clue-in version, there's a list of slides, so if someone does refer to a specific slide, you can jump forwards and backwards through the presentation to the specific slide number. I'll also remind you at this point, at the end of the training, we do look for you to provide feedback. And on the last slide of the presentation, we have a link to our feedback form. If you have to leave before we wrap up today, please take just a few minutes to fill out that feedback form. I'll also mention on our last slide, we have links to additional resources. And if you select that area of the slide, we've mentioned the LEAF method, and on our links page in section 2, the very last item listed in that section will take you over to the website that we've talked about in our previous section of the training today. Do we have any questions to start from our phone line audience? From Ed at DTSC in Sacramento, California, do trainers have any experience with stabilization techniques applied to auto shredder waste?
Hi, this is Tom Plant. I guess the answer for me is no. I'm not sure of the physical properties of auto shredder waste. Typically the solidification is applied to soils and sludges and other waste materials that can easily be blended with a set of reagents and are sort of fine enough that you get good contact. Now there is the concept of encapsulation of waste materials or larger chunks of waste within a low permeability matrix. So, I guess there is the potential that you could encapsulate materials such as these shredder wastes, but, you really got to look at the physical ability to get the contact with your reagents and then either achieve the chemical transformations or the physical binding.
This is Jim Harrington. I think I would echo what Tom said. Yeah, auto shredder waste or auto shredder fluff is really a compressible organic. It's not going to lend itself very well to being mixed with solid materials.
Thank you. Abdelatif at the Arizona DEQ in Phoenix, are the SS masses ever excavated, removed?
This is Jim Arrington. We've seen some SS materials removed as part of redevelopment, but developments have been tried to plan around it. The idea of in situ stabilization material is to leave the material there as an encapsulation method, so it's clearly not the plan. It has happened.
Yeah, this is Wilmer. Same here from in some experience here in Delaware, where you know the materials are excavated to place utilities for redevelopment purposes. So it can happen too.
Thank you. We will wrap up this question and answer break. If you did happen to take your phone off of mute, you're welcome to put it back on mute. In our system, it's *6. Put your phone back on mute. We'll continue on with the next section of our training. If you turn to slide 45, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Raj Singh at Kleinfelder. Raj?
Hi, Juliana. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Thank you, Juliana. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Raj Singh, and I will be talking about treatability study. Slide 46, please. During my presentation, you will hear about why treatability study is important, what are some of the objectives of treatability studies, what are the important factors that should be considered during treatability studying or as part of conducting treatability study. I'll also briefly discuss how a treatability study is performed and discuss a little bit about scale-up consideration from treatability test to full-scale implementation. So what's a treatability study? Treatability studies can be performed both at bench scale and pilot scale level. Bench scale treatability testing is particularly important in SS project because the reagent formulation, or also called design mix, as well as the performance criteria are developed based on the results that are obtained as part of the bench scale testing. Slide 47, please. Okay. On this slide, the process flow diagram has been shown. You have seen Tom talk about this slide, so just want to point out that the red circle, the oval circle, is the discussion items that I will be talking about. Treatability testing are typically conducted to assess the feasibility of a technology by evaluating effectiveness, implementability, and cost. A site-specific treatability testing is very important in SS because based on that treatability testing, you will be developing the design basis for the full-scale implementation of an SS project. Once the feasibility study is demonstrated, design criteria for implementation of full-scale SS system is developed and presented in the specification. You've already heard from, Tom and other presenters that the three most important performance parameters that ITRC team has considered are strength, hydraulic conductivity, and leachability. In general, prior to start of a treatability testing, the practitioner has already targeted some numerical values for these three performance parameters. These target numerical values cannot be put for implementation unless you have tested as part of treatability testing and demonstrated that the target values for these parameters can be met in the field. Let's move on to slide 48, please. So what are the treatability testing objectives? As you already know, that in in-situ stabilization solidification, reagents are mixed with impacted or contaminated material to immobilize the chemicals of concern as well as to improve the physical property of the treated material. The objectives of a treatability testing are presented on these slides. Number one, is selection of appropriate reagents for implementation. You select the right reagents that will stabilize and solidify the materials and reach the remedial goals. Number two is determine the impact of selected reagents on other contaminants. When you add reagents that have high pH, for example, if you add Portland cement, then the pH of the Portland cement is alkaline in nature, and the treated material will turn will also have a higher pH after the reagents have been mixed. As Tom has talked about, metals are amphoteric compounds, and they can have resolubilize, or they are more soluble at low pH and at high pH. So it's important to keep in mind what kind of a reagents you are adding and what will be the impact of that reagent on the treated material. And the next objective is to optimize the reagent dosages. In order to reduce the overall cost, the reagents must be optimized, or the quantity of the reagent must be optimized. Sometimes you have volatile organic present at a site along with metals and other contaminants. You may want to assess during the treatability testing how much is the emission from the volatile organics and how you will handle it in the field. Also during treatability study, you will assess how to handle the material handling issues. Will you deliver the material or the reagent in a liquid form or in a dry form? What is the best way to deliver the material to the impacted area? Next objective is to assess if the treated material is physically and chemically compatible with other materials where it might be disposed. This is especially in case where you dispose it off-site in a landfill. Will the landfill accept this treated material with the different characteristics after the reagents have been added? When you add reagents, and typically this is associated with pozzolanic material or cement, Portland cement, the volume of the material is increased. Of course, the increase in volume is dependent on the amount of reagent or the quantity of reagent that you add. So you need to assess how much excess material will be generated after it has been treated and how will you handle that. And also, the next objective, final objective, is to finalize the performance criteria. Based on the results of the treatability testing, the final performance criteria is developed and is included in the bidding document for implementation. Slide 49, please. Bench scale and pilot scale treatability testing. A typical treatability testing program in an SS project is an iterative process where optimal reagent formulations and the design performance parameters are developed to meet the remedial objectives. Bench scale testing is an economical way to test several reagents without incurring huge cost. In a pilot scale, the cost is high. The bench scale, the cost is very low compared to pilot scale. Typically, during bench scale testing, you take pre-selected candidate reagent, mix it with the untreated material, and then you test for the key performance parameters, which are strength, permeability, and leachability. On a complex site, after the treatability testing has been performed, you may want to consider a pilot testing to further verify the results of the bench scale testing. Selection of a candidate reagent requires the knowledge that the practitioner have about the process track record of the reagent in treating the contaminants that are found at the site. What will be the interference and chemical incompatibilities with the contaminants that are present at the site when you add reagents? A good understanding of metal chemistry and its behavior under different pH conditions, because the pH, as I stated, may change after addition of reagents. So how will the contaminants behave in presence of changed pH condition? Compatibility of with disposal or reuse, particularly in case of, you have to figure out if case we are sending it to offsite landfill. And cost. The cost of a reagent is a significant cost in the overall implementation of an SS project. Slide 50, please. Sample collection is critical and requires careful planning. This is an important slide, and most practitioners tend to collect the data that is not really representative and test samples that does that creates problem in the field. Collecting representative samples to perform treatability testing is a very important and critical task, because the results obtained from the treatability testing is used to develop the full-scale performance criteria or performance specifications. If you don't collect the representative sample for treatability testing, you may develop a reagent formulation that may not be based on actual media in the field. Collecting representative sample requires that you, practitioner, have a careful understanding of the site conceptual model, chemicals of concern that are present at the site, not only the contaminants that exceed the cleanup criteria, but also the chemicals that may be present and may solubilize after the addition of reagents. Location where you will collect the sample from is very important. How would you collect the sample and composite them? You cannot test too many samples because it costs too much, so how will you composite the samples for treatability testing? And also a very important aspect is to develop the conceptual site implementation plan. It's a conceptual site implementation plan which basically identifies what type of mixing equipment should be used in the field. If the contaminants are present at greater depth, then you may have to consider different type of equipment as compared to contaminants which are present typically within the top 10 to 15 feet. So there are different equipment requirements based on the depth of contamination. Essentially, the samples for treatability testing should be representative of entire site conditions, as well as the individual areas on the site if they're different. Typically, samples are collected to represent worst-case contamination scenario and average-case contamination scenarios. Slide 51, please. This is an actual slide that is, this is an actual site, actually, which is shown on this slide. You will see that the blue area on the drawing are NAPL-impacted areas. Yellow and brown area shown on this slide is impacted by arsenic. The yellow indicates low concentration of arsenic, and the brown indicates high concentration of arsenic at this site. This site is to be treated by ISS. Essentially, the site has three different areas that may potentially require three different reagents. The first area is arsenic-impacted area, second area is a NAPL-impacted area, and the third one is areas that are impacted both by arsenic and NAPL. So how should this site be treated must be considered in advance of performing a treatability testing. This way you will be able to collect representative site samples for treatability testing from each area. Once you have developed a conceptual plan how you will treat in the field, you can conduct a treatability testing, and that will be more representative of the field implementation process. Basically, you need to mimic what the field implementation will be in during the treatability testing. In the area where you have NAPL as well as arsenic, you may require a different set of reagents. In the area where you have arsenic, you may have a different set of reagents. Another consideration at this site is the depth for impacted material. You have in the central portion NZ1, you will see the depth. This area is the central portion of the site and has been identified for treatment up to 11 feet depth, NZ1 area, blue, shown in the blue. You can use a backhoe, you can use a rotary type of mixing device to go up to a depth of 11 feet and mix the reagents in this area. In area NZ2, shown on the right-hand side of the slide in blue, that area has been identified, which is NAPL-impacted area. That area has been identified for treatment depth up to 26 feet. This may be very difficult to treat using excavator or rotary mixing devices. You may have to consider an auger type of mixing device, or you may have to consider benching and then treat this area. So in essence, what I'm trying to say is that treatability testing should mimic the actual treatment to be implemented in the field. And if you don't do that, you may develop data that may not be very useful. Slide 52, please. Sample characterization. So once you collect a representative sample, what you need to do as far as testing is concerned. After the samples are collected, a baseline analysis should be performed on all the untreated sample. The physical characterization test typically may include moisture content, particle size distribution, Etterberg limits, density, hydraulic conductivity, pH, redox potential, etc. Chemical characterization may include total chemical analysis, and depending on which leaching test, you may want to select a leaching test. If you know that there are oil and grease and napal present, you should also test for those if they're present at the site. Slide 53, please. Bench scale treatability testing is a tiered approach. Basically, what it means that the testing that you perform in the previous step dictates your next step for what should be tested. In the bench scale testing, we use contaminated material, mix it with the reagent, and we go to the step-by-step process. During tier one, as shown on this slide, typically selected reagents are mixed with untreated sample to evaluate the preliminary performance parameters, which are strength and hydraulic conductivity. At this stage, you're focusing on strength and hydraulic conductivity to meet the performance criteria. Once you have a reasonable idea of the reagents that can meet the strength and hydraulic conductivity criteria, you move on to next tier, tier two here. In tier two, basically, the goal is to select reagents that will immobilize or reduce the leaching of the contaminants of concern. In addition to reagents that are selected in tier one, you add additional reagents sometimes to control the leachability or immobilizing the contaminants of concern. Once you have achieved those two goals, then you move on to the tier three, where you basically optimize the dosages of the reagents in order to reduce the cost. In tier four, you developed quality control parameters for field implementation. For example, you may want to test for what kind of a baseline consistency testing, which Tom will talk again in the implementation section, and develop quality control parameters that will be put in the plans and specification or bidding document. Slide 54, please. So what are the laboratory testing after you have mixed the reagents at a bench scale level? This slide shows some of the contaminated raw material, how they look like. You can see that they are tarry and oily material. This is from one of the actual sites. The bottom right-hand side shows a nice cylinder that has been formed after you mix the reagent. We typically tend to put them in a mold, cylindrical mold, for further testing. So you can see that the loose, untreated material has turned into a solid monolith at the bench scale level. The right-hand side lower photograph shows that. Let's move on to slide 55, please. So the analysis that would be conducted on typical treated materials are chemical testing, and chemical testing may include total chemical analysis or analysis for only the chemicals of concern, and leaching test. Documenting pH of the extract, if you're doing an SPLP or any other leaching test, that is an important parameter, and it helps in assessing if you somehow don't meet the remedial goals. The other physical test may consist of strength and hydraulic conductivity as a minimum. Slide 56, please. So once you have obtained the results after the treatability testing has been performed, so how do we evaluate the results? This slide presents example of three performance parameters that ITRC has selected to be the most important parameters and the numerical values that are used at some sites, not all sites, some sites. I do want to emphasize here that these numerical criteria for these performance criteria, three of the performance criteria listed on the slide, are not to be construed as a recommendation by ITRC. Every site should develop its own performance criteria. These are just some examples. Strength is measured in terms of unconfined compressive strength and typically may range from 50 to 100 PSI. However, there have been sites where 25 PSI has been acceptable in many at several sites. Hydraulic conductivity value may range from 5 times 10 to the power minus 6 centimeters per second to 1 time 10 to the power minus 6 centimeters per second. And leachability criteria for chemicals of concern are developed based on several factors that are outlined on this slide. At this stage of the project, you have basically identified the remedial goals or leachability and some of the factors that are considered to identify leachability are presented. Slide 57, please. This slide shows the next steps after completing the treatability testing. The results obtained from the bench scale treatability testing will be used to develop construction performance specification for full-scale ISS implementation. If the performance criteria are somehow not met, the performance specification, the process, and the performance goal may need to be reevaluated, revised, and a separate treatability testing may need to be repeated, as shown on this flowchart. Slide 58, please. Pilot test and field demonstration. Once the selection of design mix or the design reagent formulation has been developed from bench scale treatability testing, the next phase of the project may include a pilot test. A pilot test is intended to verify the process variables selected as part of the bench scale testing and, if required, further optimize it and develop other parameters that can be implemented in the field, or construction parameters that can be implemented during the full scale. Pilot tests should be performed using the actual implementation plan for full scale implementation in the field. And that's important consideration. Slide 59, please. Scale up consideration. At this stage of the project, the practitioner has already developed the chemistry of stabilization solidification. The scale-up from bench scale to full-scale implementation is generally focused on material handling aspects of the SS project. Scale-up from bench scale to full-scale implementation should address some of the factors like equipment, type of equipment that should be considered. Some of the equipment for mixing are shown over here. On the left-hand side is an auger, then rotary blending and the jet grouting type is shown on this slide. Chemical reagent. How would you store the chemical reagent at the field? How will you deliver? Will it be delivered in liquid and solid form? What's the best way of delivering the reagents? Should stabilization be performed in step one, or can stabilization and solidification both be performed at the same time? Mixing and curing time. How long does it take to mix a particular cell homogeneously, and how much time does it take to cure? Quality assurance parameters should also be developed as part of the scale-up process. For example, one of them is, how will you ensure that the correct quantity of reagents are being added to the correct individual cells? These are some of the things you should be developing during scale-up consideration. Slide 60, please. What are some of the takeaway points? The slide summarizes the takeaway points of my talk. A bench scale testing is important for developing and optimizing reagent mix design. Sampling from treatability testing is crucial. What type of sample should be considered? And for treatability testing, that's an important consideration. Treatability testing should mimic the field implementation approach, depending on the depth of the treatment and what type of reagents you should be adding in what form, sequence, and all of that. Use of appropriate tests to obtain data that can be used as part of groundwater modeling if it is needed. Tom had talked about where you stabilize and where is the point of compliance. So you should use a test that should be helpful in developing a groundwater modeling if needed. And finally, the key performance parameters are strength, relative hydraulic conductivity, and leachability. That ends my talk, and now I invite Tom to talk about implementation aspects of the ISS project.
All right, thank you, Raj. So slide 61, kind of here's where we're at in the presentation. So let's first take a moment to recap where we are in the training and within the solidification stabilization process. So Wilmer has defined for us what stabilization solidification is and what are some of the ways it's implemented. I talked earlier about how solidified materials behave in the environment, the most common performance parameters being strength, hydraulic conductivity, and leachability, and the more common performance tests. And Raj just presented the key considerations in performing bench scale and pilot scale treatability evaluations. So the next step, once a mix design has been developed that meets the project's performance specifications and the site performance or remedial goals, is to hire a remediation contractor and implement the treatment. So during this phase where we perform the remedial construction, we need to document and verify that the treatment is successfully meeting the performance specifications. This topic of solidification stabilization implementation considerations is covered in Section 6 of the ITRC document. The solidification stabilization equipment and methods are summarized in Appendix A of the guidance document. And Raj spoke a little bit about those. Now, moving on to slide 62. So this slide lists the topics that I'll cover in this portion of the training, which are the importance of performance verification during implementation, field sampling and testing considerations, monitoring and evaluation of test data, and finally, long-term performance of solidification stabilization remedies. Slide 63, please. So why is performance verification so important? Well, as with any site remediation approach, the ability to achieve site closure on all or a portion of a site requires demonstration to owners, regulators, and other stakeholders that the implementation of the remedy is able to meet the project's performance specifications and that variations or problems can be identified and resolved as construction progresses. For solidification stabilization, some of the performance verification aspects that are typically monitored or tested include consistent reagent mix preparation, thorough blending of the reagents with contaminated materials in the correct proportions, sampling and testing of treated materials for comparison to performance criteria, and verifying that the entire volume of contaminated material has been treated. Slide 64, please. Now, we obviously want to perform sampling and testing to document compliance with the performance specifications. However, in addition, frequent sampling and testing of treated materials allows for adjustments to be made in response to variations in material characteristics or site conditions. And this is a common occurrence at many contaminated sites. Variations in contaminant concentrations, in moisture conditions, in fill or soil, or waste properties, among many others, can all impact the treatment effectiveness. I recently completed an ISS project on a coal tar site where we encountered mixed gravelly fill and clay soils throughout the site with widely varying moisture contents. We ended up using a slump test in the field to determine if additional water or if a thicker grout mix was needed to adequately blend the soils and reagents and to maintain a consistent final product with predictable strength and permeability results. Now, it's also important to recognize that treating materials and making adjustments before the material sets up significantly is always going to be preferable than trying to retreat materials, especially when solidification to a monolith form is desired. Once the material has sufficiently hardened, especially with the cementitious reagents, it no longer behaves as a soil-like or sludge-like material, so additional treatment may not be very effective. If you think of breaking up a partially cured concrete specimen, you know, if you add more grout or reagent and remix it, it doesn't allow additional homogenization of that originally treated material. You're essentially just encapsulating fractured material that you previously treated. So again, retreatment isn't really all that effective, so you really want to get it right the first time if you can. Slide 65, please. This slide illustrates a site plan for a solidification project performed on a coal tar site. A key aspect of performance verification is to keep track of what areas have been treated, how much reagent was used, where quality control samples were collected, and what were the test results from each of these areas. This allows the project team to track progress, ensure that all waste areas are treated, and to identify areas where differing conditions may be affecting the treatment performance. On this particular site, this tracking was used to identify an area where additional reagent was needed due to excessive soil moisture in an area where very coarse sand and gravel was not encountered during the site investigation, but was sort of additionally diluting the mixed material with additional water, so it was not setting up as well. Now, on slide 66, I have a couple photos of sampling and sample specimen preparation for freshly treated material. In the upper left photo, it's a little hard to see, but it shows a pipe-type sampling device for sampling discrete intervals in soil mix columns. This is essentially a long pipe with a sample port that is pushed down into the freshly mixed column, and you can extract a discrete sample at a specified depth. For shallower treatment depths, an excavator bucket may be an adequate sampling device, and this is shown in the upper right photo. Now, in the lower left photo, this shows the use of a soil sieve or screen to remove oversized particles from the field mixed material that's going to be used to make the cured specimens. Now, this is a requirement for many of the ASTM methods for soil cement specimens for strength and hydraulic conductivity testing. Essentially, you want to take out the larger pieces and rocks and stones that would affect the testing of a small specimen size, and then wouldn't reflect the actual properties or performance of the material. On the bottom right photo shows numerous samples being cured in the field under moist conditions, usually in a cooler with some level of water and with caps on the specimens. Moisture, temperature, moisture and temperature are critical conditions that need to be maintained during specimen curing, especially the first few days. The durability, the strength, the hydraulic conductivity of the cured specimens are all influenced by the curing environment. So again, what you don't want to do is have your curing environment affect your test results, because then they're not going to be representative of the actual material treated in place. And finally, it's a good idea to prepare extra specimens for testing from many of the cells that you solidify, so that, you know, if you get some non-conforming results before you decide to retest or it's a failing area, having those extra specimens available to run another test to develop a little bit more data and understand what the problem is usually a good first course of action. Slide 67. Now, this slide introduces the two types of performance verification tests that are important to consider. These are consistency tests and compliance tests. both of which would have been evaluated in the bench and pilot study phases. The consistency tests include real-time or short-term observations and testing to determine if the treated material behaves consistent with your baseline observations from the bench and pilot phases. The compliance tests include the use of specified performance tests for direct comparison to project performance criteria. So together, the consistency and compliance tests and their acceptance criteria used during construction are the construction performance specifications that were described previously in this training. In the top photo here, this is basically a 5-gallon bucket sample. These are good for visual observation in the field. You basically take a freshly mixed material, you don't run it through a screen, put it in a 5-gallon bucket, let it cure a couple days, and then just, you know, empty it out and break it. And it gives you a good look at the cured material and how well the waste materials are mixed or encapsulated. And then the compliance testing, obviously the photo here is an unconfined compressive strength test. Moving on to slide 68, here's some additional examples of consistency tests. I talked about visual observation in the last slide. A slump test comes from the concrete testing industry, and the slump base of a freshly treated material basically reflects the moisture content, the reagent content, the density, the cohesiveness, and the viscosity properties of freshly treated material. And if you can maintain a consistent slump of your treated material, then it's a good indication that all your material is being treated the same and that you're accounting for some variations in the material. And you know, the results should follow and be fairly consistent from your compliance test. Short-term strength gain over the first several days of curing can also be used just to verify that the cement hydration reactions are actually occurring. This chart in the lower right-hand corner presents some data developed in the bench scale, so a strength gain curve with the blue diamonds and the black line. And then during the field demonstration or pilot test, we collected similar samples and tested them. And, you know, what this showed us was that for the most part, the samples were curing at least as well as they were in the lab, but there was one area, the red squares, field demonstration one area, that was curing at a slower rate. But in the end, we did some later testing at like 56 days, and we found that even though the curing was slower in some cells, ultimately it was able to achieve the minimum compressive strength and other properties. Now, in some cases, we may also do some short-term leaching tests in the field or with field-treated material, especially when you're treating metals and you want to demonstrate that the stabilization reactions in the field are actually occurring, especially where they're key to the treatment. On slide 69, compliance tests will typically involve specific performance tests which were developed as part of the project's performance specifications, and they may include strength and hydraulic conductivity at a specified cure time, and possibly leaching performance, again, more typical in a stabilization treatment. Other chemical tests, such as the final pH on treated materials, may also be a consideration if pH-dependent stabilization is a treatment goal. Slide 70. So this slide presents some considerations in evaluating field performance data. Now, in setting performance criteria and how test data will be evaluated, we first need to consider the remedial objectives for the treatment by solidification and ask a couple of questions. Number one, is the bulk performance of the treated mass an acceptable measure of remedy success? And also, must every test result pass the performance criteria? Now, one has to recognize that typically the material to be treated in the field will vary in both physical and chemical properties, both of which can affect the mixed design effectiveness. And it may not always be possible to fully assess this variation during a site investigation and treatability testing. So while you need to, you know, anticipate some adjustments in the mixed design during implementation, you also need to realize that, you know, just because one or two results fail in a very large treatment area does not necessarily mean the whole remediation is failing or that those areas should be retreated. Slide 71 introduces the concept of data tracking charts. This particular slide is a quality control tracking chart for unconfined compressive strength tests in which we used a tolerance or a tolerance interval, or we allowed some tolerance of a few results not meeting the performance criteria. If they were within a certain maximum deviation from our minimum performance criteria. So in this case, our criteria was 50 PSI. The vast majority of results exceeded that. There were a couple of results that did not. If they were, less than 10 PSI, lower than our performance criteria, we considered that acceptable. There were a couple of results that we considered unacceptable. So we went back and test pitted those areas and determined that they were not sufficiently mixed. So those were areas we actually remixed to address the nonconformance. Other types of control charts may be useful as well, such as tracking moving averages to inform decision-making during construction. Test results variation may indicate a need to test replicate samples or make adjustments in the treatment. Section 6.3 of the guidance document provides some additional discussion on evaluation of field performance data. Now on slide 72, the last item for this portion of the training is a brief discussion of the long-term performance of solidification stabilization remedies. This topic is covered in section 7.1 of the guidance document and references several papers and reports. There have been a few documented studies of treated sites where post-treatment samples were collected up to about 16 years after treatment. In these studies, samples were subjected to physical, geochemical, and leaching tests, and in some cases, microstructure and mineralogy evaluations. Geochemical speciation modeling was also performed for some sites. Collectively, these studies have affirmed that solidification stabilization treatment, when properly designed and implemented, provides long-term control of contaminant release and can be expected to last on the order of decades to centuries. Now, slide 73, just to reiterate the use of solidification stabilization and its long-term performance, Wilmer previously showed this slide, and it illustrates the frequency of use of solidification by EPA on solidification stabilization, on CERCLA sites. Overall, approximately 217 or more EPA projects have incorporated some form of solidification stabilization treatment into the remedy. And this is in addition to, the numerous non-Superfund remediation projects performed every year using solidification stabilization through either state-led or voluntary programs. So slide 74, just to wrap up this section of the training, a couple of key points to remember regarding ISS implementation. The performance verification process during implementation is critical to documenting and verifying the success of treatment. Secondly, sample collection, testing, and observations can incorporate both short-term or real-time consistency tests as well as compliance tests on fully cured materials. And solidification stabilization is a viable long-term treatment technology which has been used on a variety of wastes, and there have been several studies documenting its long-term performance. So moving back to our outline, I'm going to transition to the final segment of training, which will be presented by Jim Harrington on long-term stewardship and monitoring for solidification sites, and I'll also present an example of in-situ solidification case study.
Thank you, Tom. We're getting to the end. This is Section 7, the last section in this training. We've gone through the process so far. We've set goals, developed mixed formulas, designed a remedy, implemented a remedy, verified that the remedy was built as designed, but we're not finished yet. As earlier speakers have indicated, the contaminants remain in the treated mass. Some are stabilized and some are solidified. Some have the The leachability has been changed forever, as long as the conditions don't change. Some are just contained, but long-term stewardship is needed to ensure that the remedy continues as implemented initially. Slide 76, please. Long-term stewardship and a case study. This is the thesis of this presentation. I'm going to talk about the importance of the conceptual site model and review of the project goals, the objectives of long-term stewardship, the use of groundwater monitoring, and then lastly, I'll talk about a site that was remediated, the Peak Oil case study. Slide 76, please. Now, the importance of site model and goals. This is the flowchart you've seen a number of times so far. And while we're close to the end, it's appropriate to return to the beginning. Where do we start? First, we constructed an accurate site model. What were the conditions before remediation? Where did we want to get to? And we set overall project goals. For example, in many cases, the goal is reaching the MCL for drinking water. And we established points of compliance at which to accomplish the goals. Sometimes it's a site boundary. Sometimes it's immediately downgrading of the stabilized matrix. It's selected on a site-by-site basis, and that's part of the design of the implementation of the remedy. The two questions we're trying to answer is, what do we want to accomplish, and why are we monitoring to see if the remedy is still implemented? Slide 78, please. Conceptual site model. You've seen this before. This is a conceptual site model of an actual site. You have a stabilized matrix, a monolith in gold, and it's capped by a low permeable cover in green. There's blue dots on top that says precipitation coming through, and the purple dots are the leaching. As pointed out, the leaching is much reduced in the stabilization solidification, but it's not completely stopped. And as you see in this cartoon, the purple drops migrate to the left of the picture, which is the direction of groundwater flow towards the property boundary, which is considered the point of compliance to the site. The groundwater monitoring is necessary to determine the monolith performs as designed, that the flux or loading of contaminants released remain very low over time, and monitoring will also demonstrate that the levels in the groundwater migrate towards and achieve the point of compliance over time. Slide 79, please. Long-term stewardship objectives. Two main points is to confirm that the monolith is performing the design and ensure that the groundwater meets the target. The two pictures you have here is a site in Florida before and after treatment. Before treatment, it was a waste pile with creosote, and after treatment, it's being used as a storage yard for construction equipment. It's been remediated and it's been put back into reuse. Slide 80, please. As I indicated in the first part of the presentation, you need to do some groundwater monitoring to demonstrate that the remedy remains in place. This is to talk about what are the considerations for your groundwater monitoring design. What are your monitoring points? Compliance may be at one or more specific points adjacent to the stabilized matrix or at the point of compliance, which may be the property boundary. What are you monitoring for? By now, even before you implement the remedy, you completed the remedial investigation feasibility study, you know what the contaminants of concern are. So the contaminants of concern that you monitor for would be a reduced list, and that the contaminants that are the major contaminants that the remedy was implemented for. Where are the monitoring locations? It's dependent on the site conditions. We've had a couple of sites in New York State that have been stabilized or adjacent to the Hudson River, and there really wasn't any place for groundwater monitoring. So that's one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, you might have a site that's a long way from any water bodies, and you might have monitoring locations near the monolith, at the boundary line, and further down gradient to demonstrate that the stabilized matrix has reduced the flux of contamination into the groundwater, and that the groundwater attenuates as time goes by. When the remedy is implemented, it may stop the leaching of contaminant into the groundwater, but that doesn't mean there isn't a large amount of contamination already in the groundwater, which has to move through, migrate through the groundwater and attenuate. The monitoring location is dependent on site conditions, potential changes in the groundwater flow regime induced by the treated material. The treated monoliths basically have zero hydraulic conductivity, so the groundwater that's moving across the site is going to have to stop and go around the treated monolith. So the groundwater, just downgrading of the treated monolith, may actually be stagnant, and it would be a very poor place to gauge whether the monolith has an impact on migrating groundwater, because it's really not moving. That groundwater may stay contaminated, but since it's no longer moving, it's not impacting the environment. Depending on state or federal remediation goals, cleanup criteria may be applied at site differently. The application of cleanup criteria can range from compliance at one or more points of compliance everywhere on the site within an impacted aquifer, demonstration of a percent reduction in concentration due to the reduced flux, and may be based on modeling the acceptable attenuation. In some cases, the stabilization solidification is used as part of a treatment train. It's used to address the source of groundwater contamination, and if the contamination is already in the ground or still needs to be addressed, more groundwater remedies may be required further downgrading. Next slide, please. 81. The frequency and duration of monitoring is driven by a number of things. The Superfund, the Federal CERCLA, has a number of requirements. Generally require quarterly monitoring to start, changing to annual monitoring, and as needed for 5-year reviews. CERCLA requires a 5-year review for all sites where contamination still exists, and this would apply to that. State programs usually follow the CERCLA frequency for quarter and annual monitoring, but may have specific differences depending on how the regulations are written, and they may vary in requirements for the 5-year review periods. In New York, our regulation requires periodic review, which generally has been 18 months, and in some sites the time period is longer based on the results of the initial periodic review. Predictive modeling can be used to further identify the appropriate monitoring frequency and duration. If you have a site where the groundwater moves very slowly, it may not make any sense to monitor for the first 2 or 3 years because you know that nothing is going to change because of the speed of groundwater if you can't find an acceptable monitoring location very, very close to the monolith. So you would do some hydraulic modeling to determine the length of travel time to get to an appropriate place where you can monitor. Slide 82, please. Now you need to interpret. Now you've collected this monitoring data, and you have to interpret it. As I indicated earlier, the groundwater is not magically going to meet MCLs 3 days after you implement the remedy. It takes time. You need to collect some monitoring and evaluate concentration trends over time to demonstrate or confirm that the decreasing or acceptably low concentration of contaminants of concern near the monolith, there's decreasing concentrations to the point of compliance, and that your modeling shows that you can, that you will achieve the MCLs over time. And in cases where the requirements for the stabilization remedy were not a achievement of MCLs, it may be requirement of a percent reduction in groundwater contamination, and your monitoring data should show that. Slide 83, please. As I indicated, there is still contamination in the ground beneath the site within the stabilized matrix. And in that case, you need to have institutional engineering controls to ensure that the remedy continues to be protective of human health or environment. And administrative controls, institutional controls are generally administrative in nature. There are requirements such as do not excavate, or any excavation must be done within a soil management plan to ensure that no contaminated material is moved to the surface. You're not allowed to install wells without appropriate treatment. And there, if the remedy includes a cap, that the integrity of the cap is maintained to ensure there's no exposure. Engineering controls are physical methods to prevent exposure, and they include impervious caps and vertical walls. They've been used on a number of federal Superfund sites. The picture here is a federal Superfund site where the site was stabilized, covered with a cap, and a vertical slurry wall was put around the site to capture the migrating groundwater that had happened before the mass was stabilized. Site reuse will have a significant influence on the design and protective measures. As I think I talked about in the question and answer period, we've had sites in New York where we had to remove some of the stabilized matrix to allow redevelopment. If the redevelopment plans are known before the remedy is implemented, that can be taken into account. For example, we have removed some of the contaminated material that would have been stabilized and taken off site and stabilized the remainder so as to allow the redevelopment of the site. And I think Tom talked about it in his answer to the question about retesting material. Once you have the mass stabilized, you really don't want to have to go back into it. So the design of the remedy should take into account redevelopment plans if they're known at that point. In New York, the stabilization remedies are all set up below the frost level so that the integrity of the monolith will remain. Slide 84. This is a slide on reuse examples. The first site is a battery recycling site. It was contaminated with lead and spent battery casings. It's now being used as a wildlife habitat. Since the site was in Florida, and it was remediated using a moving pile. The pile on the right of the top left picture is the untreated material. It was taken down and mixed with reagents in the middle, and the treated material is on the left. When it was all treated, then the material was replaced onto the site, and this wildlife habitat created. The second site is a wood preserving site in Tennessee. It was also treated ex situ, and the picture on the right shows it to be being used as a storage yard. Slide 85, please. The last piece of my presentation relates to the Peak Oil Superfund site. Peak Oil Superfund site, and this is a site that was in Florida. The Peak Oil company conducted an oil refinery operation for used oil and lubricating fluids. They used an acid clay purification process and filtration process. This process generated a low pH sludge and oil-saturated clay waste. It generated and it was stored on-site and unlined with lagoons. There were three large lagoons. In 1986, EPA came in with a removal action and excavated one of the lagoons and treated it using on-site mobile incineration and replaced the untreated sludge. They put the ash back in the lagoon that it came from. They decided that was not the right remedy for the site, and they stopped. They came back a few years later and revised the remedy to on-site solidification stabilization. And the primary contaminant for this site was lead, again. It was up to 3,000 milligrams per kilogram in the residual ash and 3,500 milligrams per kilogram in the waste clay. And the contaminant matrix also included volatile chemicals, including toluene, ethylbenzene, xylenes, semi-volatiles, PAHs, PCBs, and inorganics, including barium, chromium, and lead. This was a very contaminated site. Next site, please. next slide, please. I'm sorry. It's the post-oil remediation of peak oil site. Again, you're seeing the conceptual site model of the site. And you have a stabilized matrix monolith covered by a cap. You have precipitation coming down and a reduced amount of leachate leaving out. And the question you're trying to answer here is how much lead can stay in the leachate and still comply with the performance specification for the site, which was meeting the groundwater standard at the point of compliance. Point of compliance was the site boundary. The groundwater standard for lead is 15 micrograms per liter. And using modeling and the specific groundwater flow volume and pathway, it determined the acceptable flux that could be released from the groundwater and still meet the goal, considering the site of the site-specific amount of groundwater available for dilution. The modeling considered the size and shape of the monolith, local rainfall, type of cap to determine infiltration, and location of the monolith, which was partly within the groundwater table and partly in the valence zone. Next slide, please, number 87. The objective of the peak oil groundwater monitoring was to determine the allowable concentration of lead in the leachate using the SPLT test to meet groundwater goals at the point of compliance. As I said before, 15 micrograms per liter for lead site boundary. The modeling result was the leachate, as determined by SPLT, could be 282 micrograms per liter of lead in the leachate, and the natural attenuation or the attenuation of the groundwater between the monolith and the point and the boundary, which is the point of compliance, would still achieve 15 micrograms per liter. I skipped a piece of the remedy. I want to go back to that for a second. Slide 85. The this process was done as an ex situ stabilization project. The material was excavated, put in a conveyor, and pretreated with trisodium phosphate to condition the soil. Then it was treated with Portland cement, put into a plug mill, and mixed, and then was allowed to cure. And the point of this is this was more than just a one-step operation. Triple sodium phosphate was used, and with some time was allowed for it to work, and then it was mixed with the Portland cement to be stabilized. Going back to slide 88, and this is the construction performance parameters for the peak oil site, as determined by the remedial investigation feasibility study. All soils with lead levels greater than 521 milligrams per kilogram, parts per million, was treated at the site. That determination was made on a site-specific basis, looking at the conditions and the nature and extent of the contamination. The SS mixed composition included 6% by weight Portland cement and 1-2% triple superphosphate. As I indicated earlier, that was done in a two-step process. The specifications were strength, 50 PSI, unconfined compressor strength that Tom talked about earlier using method ASTM D1633. There's a hydraulic conductivity limitation of 1 times 10 to the minus 6 centimeters per second, with a variance allowed to some samples to 1 times 10 to the minus 5 centimeters per second. That was method ASTM D5084. And then the leaching was looked at using the modeling that I just talked about. As long as it was less than 282 micrograms per liter was acceptable, with a variance of some samples up to 500 using the SPLP pre-method of 1312. And all performance criteria at the site were met. Other controls at the site included groundwater monitoring, institutional controls, and 5-year reviews. Slide 89. This is a picture of the peak oil site following remediation, and I'll call your attention to the gray structure in the front of the photograph, the foreground of the photograph. That's an actual flume that carries the surface water drain that drains the parking lot in front of the building to the left over the site to reduce the potential for any infiltration of surface water in through the matrix. Please, that ends my presentation. I'll turn it over to Wilmer at slide 90. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. If we please move to slide number 91, this slide pretty much concludes our presentation for today. In this presentation, we have covered important details on how to select and evaluate performance specifications for solidification stabilization remedies. We have emphasized the role of performance specifications during the design and implementation, and presenting also consideration for long-term stewardship programs. It is important to remember that all these topics are covered in the guidance in further detail. What we would like is to people who are attending this training to use the guidance as a tool when addressing performance in the remediation projects. In this way, we will build consistency on the use of performance specification and evaluation of remedy success. This concludes my our presentation. Now I'm turning the presentation over to Juliana for the second and last question and answer break.
Thanks, Wilmer. On slide 92, if you're in the simulcast audience or if you're in the phone audience and might send in your questions, you're welcome to use that orange question mark at the top of the slide to start sending in questions. We are going to get to as many of those as we can in the next 15 minutes. Before we get to those questions, let's go to the links to additional resources and the feedback form. So you're welcome to select either area of that slide. If you do go to the links to additional resources, looking to the left, under the Clue in Sun and the navigation, the third item down takes you over to the feedback form. We do look for everybody on today's call to take just a few minutes to give us your feedback. We really do use the information. On the links page, the first item listed, download ITRC's training. This is what allows you to download the PowerPoint presentation that you've seen during today's training class. We also have a link to the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance Document, Development of Performance Specifications for Solidification Stabilization. We've introduced you to this document during today's training, and we do encourage you to go over to the ITRC website where you can download a PDF of the document. Our ITRC team also has a team page with additional information. We've talked very briefly about a couple of other ITRC tools, and I do encourage you to review the website to see what information is available for you. And in the past, we have run out of time for questions, so we do have a link for remaining simulcast questions and the answers that our trainers later provided for those questions. Looking in Section 2, we referred to some of these during today's training class, and here's a collection of references for you. We do now want to get to as many questions as we can. For our simulcast audience, it's back on the slides, that orange question mark button at the top that allows you to send in questions. For the phone line audience, you're welcome to ask questions out loud. It's #6 to unmute in our system. So to unmute your phone, you want to unmute on your phone as well as select #6 to unmute in the conference call system. And when you ask a question, please state your name, your organization, and where you're calling in from. Do you have any questions to start from the phone line audience? We have a couple questions left over from the first question and answer break from Sandra at Coeur d'Alene Tribe in Idaho. What are the different treatment options for wet versus dry? Specifically, in a wet situation, do you have to pump the groundwater out in order to get a good solidification?
This is Tom Plant with Haley and Aldrich. So for doing solidification in the ground, you can do it both above and below the water table, and you don't have to pump out the groundwater. You do want to make sure when you're doing your treatability testing that, you know, you grab samples from the zone that you're going to be treating so that the moisture content of the materials can be factored into your mix design and how much water you may need to add to make your grout to mix. most of the in situ mixing is done by injecting a wet or a water-based slurry of reagents. That helps with the mixing. There are situations for such as an impoundment with sludge or other, you know, materials that inherently have a very high water content where you can actually mix the reagents, you know, typically maybe with an excavator or a rotary mixer, just mixing dry reagents to account for the high moisture content. So you can kind of do both. Soils, again, typically is more of a wet grout basis, but both are possible.
At the first question answer break, James Ferguson at the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control in Columbia sent in a comment. Everything relayed so far has been idealized, to say the least. Perhaps to be covered later in the course, need to hear how the realities of geologic heterogeneity are tackled. Trainers, would you like to comment?
Now this is Tom again. I'll try and tackle that one. So you're right. There are you know, heterogeneities you're going to find. I think we did cover that a little bit in the training, although we had a lot of material to cover. So you know, inevitably things are going to vary. So when you do your and Raj touched upon this, your site characterization and your selection of locations to collect materials to be treated, you need to as best you can account for, you know, low and average levels of contamination and also what you might consider hotspots for your contamination, but also identify the geologic variations. You know, in some sites you may have a layering of strata from, you know, sandy to clay to peat. So you really need to evaluate, you know, all of those separately initially in your treatability testing and determine which ones really drive, you know, your mix design and whether or not you need more than one mix design. And then getting into construction, you know, you can vary, you really need to be prepared to vary your reagent content. You may need some more reagent or more water for particularly challenging areas. So again, just to reiterate, you know, you need to be prepared. Even though things work well in the lab, you know, that's a case where a separate pilot study using full-scale equipment might be appropriate if you've got a particularly challenging site so you can identify these variations and account for them in your final design, you know, before you get out for full-scale construction.
From Eileen Hughes at DTSC in Berkeley, California, do presenters have any experience using SS on sites of cultural or historic significance?
This is Jim Herring. We haven't had any. I kind of shudder at the thought of that. We've tried other remedies at cultural and historic sites of historic interest, and it's always been very difficult because you are changing the ground, so to speak. Tom?
Yeah, I don't have any specific experience related to that.
Yeah, me either. This is Wilmer. Me either.
I can't anticipate what you want.
Yeah, I mean, one challenge with ISS, unless you get into a jet grouting approach that you can maybe do, you know, at angles to get beneath structures you don't want to disturb, which can be done, but it can be very expensive. You know, ISS typically involves, you know, getting everything else out of your way that overlies the material you need to treat, you know, debris, foundations, structures. So, you know, you pretty much are wiping the slate clean in terms of current features of the site when you're going to do solidification in situ.
This is Raj. You can do, we are looking at a project where we are considering horizontal wells where we would just be doing stabilization part, not the solidification, to convert the metals to precipitate and insoluble forms using horizontal wells.
A question question from Steve Warner at Draper Aid & Associates in Richmond, Virginia. Can in-situ SS be applicable to clayey sand, sandy clay soils with gravel and small cobbles?
This is Raj. It depends on depth. We have a site where we have cobbles which are in 5 feet thickness. And we were doing using 8 feet diameter auger to go down to 45 feet depth. And we experienced the augers were getting stuck when they reached the cobblestone area. And it became very difficult. So yes, it is a challenge, and it depends on the depth. If you are only within the top 10 feet, cobbles are there, 10, 15 feet, I think there are mixing devices, rotary type mixing devices, pretty powerful enough that can mix cobble, and I'm assuming it's cobble, not big rocks or anything like that. If there are large diameter rocks or anything like that, you may have to remove that. But it is a challenge, and if it's shallow, then you can do it using certain rotary type of mix. But if it's a deep, it becomes a very difficult and challenging process.
Steve also asked, is disking an appropriate method for in-situ mixing of shallow contaminated soils from ground surface to depth of 2.5 feet?
This is Tom Planta. I've seen that method described in some of the literature. You know, I think it depends on what you're trying to treat and the mechanism of treatment. So obviously, you know, disking and several passes to a very shallow depth can mix soils with some reagents, certainly in lime stabilization to improve soil properties. I'm aware of that being done. When you're really looking for intimate contact of your solidification or stabilization reagents with the soil materials, I guess the question I'd raise that one would want to look into more is, can the disking achieve adequate homogenization to achieve your treatment goals? That would be the real question.
Do you have questions from our phone line audience? From Steve Diamond at SNME Inc. in Atlanta, any standout safety concerns that should be considered?
You know, on some sites, this is Tom Plant, if you're dealing with some organic contaminants and potentially volatile contaminants, there's certainly an air emissions component that you need to investigate. And in some cases, sort of vacuum shrouds have been used over the mixing equipment at the ground surface to basically, remove any vapors and run them through a vapor treatment system. You really have to watch the compatibility or the reactivity of the reagents you add with the contaminants in place. Just as an example, one of our team members, Ed Bates, formerly of EPA, had a site that he worked on where I believe it was an acid sludge that they were solidifying, and when the cementitious, the alkaline reagents were added, it was a very violent reaction because you're basically adding a base to an acid, so to speak. So they quickly had to come up with an alternate approach to moderate the low pH condition of the waste as a pretreatment and then continue with the solidification treatment. So there are potential safety issues involved with the treatment.
Steve Warner at Draper Aid & Associates in Richmond, Virginia, is looking for cost preliminary estimating cost information, including in-situ stabilization per cubic yard, design pre-remediation testing costs, actual site remediation costs, and confirmation testing. Do you have any references to recommend for him?
This is Raj. There are EPA documents that do provide some cost basis. In general, what we have seen, depending on site, it is quite variable, anywhere from $50 per cubic yard or per ton, actually, to if you consider dewatering, it could be $125 to $150 per ton. Certain sites, as Tom indicated, you don't need to dewater, then the cost would be a lot less, but the amount of reagent may be a little bit more. So anywhere from $50 per ton to $150 per ton is a good range for overall cost per ton of treated material.
Thank you. And thank you all for joining us on today's training. We do need to wrap up. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you have not already, please fill out that feedback form. We do use the information. You can find more information on ITRC on our website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.